Yeah, I will just start the recording because I want to do this. Yes.
That was like a golden shower.
So that's a, and maybe I will take a picture for the.
Do you understand the people podcast? Who are listening to us, they cannot see what you're doing. Let me help you. Good. Now Christian is pouring some beer from Oktoberfest into a glass from Destiny.
Maybe we can do it like this. Can you hold it? Like.
This is the official song of Avaria.
So, insert passwords, episode 11, I guess.
Episode 11, after a long, long pause.
Is this the first one in English?
No, we concentrated on the technology stack.
True.
We refactored everything.
Refactored everything and throw everything else under the bus and started new.
I'm still in the 17th century and you are in the future.
That's true. More go for the future, for the world. So, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Yeah, we have a guest today.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Albert.
Wait.
I come from Barcelona. I'm very happy to be in the show. Big fan.
Big fan.
I follow it since 2 years ago.
Have you ever heard one episode?
Yes. the first two ones. Problem is that my German is limited, so...
Yeah. Yeah, we had two in German. Yeah, that's true.
Right. Those are the ones that I was listening. So, fantastic.
Cool.
Yeah.
So Christian basically forced Albert and me to do.
No, that's not true. We had a what party was it?
Party number five.
No, it was just a dinner, right?
Yes.
When we got a little bit drunk, and then you said, as far as I remember, you said you complained that you're never on the podcast. So
no.
Change this today.
I said that you could enrich your podcast by having different people in your shows.
Yeah.
And I told you could. Invite people to the show, not to let them talk what they want to say, but to use them so you could talk more.
That's the whole purpose of the podcast.
Okay.
You make me unemployed, Albert.
That's my job.
Now we're directly into...
There you go. But
we already had Patrick on the show, right?
Yeah, we had Patrick.
You had Patrick. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm the second guy. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm over. Done.
And I already asked Christopher for another one.
Ach so, session.
So we get going with that. I'm totally unprepared, as usual.
Yeah, the topic today is Albert is a SRE, staff SRE.
Ooh.
Ooh. So today I thought we could talk...
No, staff senior.
Isn't senior...
Or senior replaced by staff.
I like to call it SS SRE.
Oh. Wait, explicit now.
Yeah. Now we have to mark explicit. Yeah, I think the Spanish were long friends with the Germans.
Oh, come on. It's not a history podcast. And I don't like the trajectory. Here we go. No, today I thought we could talk about DevOps and OpsDev or whatever. So how operation changed and what the developers have to say about it. So I read an article a couple of weeks ago where the sentiment was that DevOps... taught operations to be more developers so that everything is code, that you have a nice inventory that you can put in Git, and then when you have a change it's a pull request basically, and then you can run your operations more in a software developer way, that you have everything committed and everything in version control. And so operations went a little bit in the direction of developers in this regard. But what was missing, or what is missing, or I don't know, that's up to discussion, is that the developers got more involved into operations, I think. And maybe 1 year ago or 2 years ago with this new Linux container thing, this is a little bit on the way, that developers are able to spin up stuff and that they really can do some ops on their workstation, for instance. And even, I mean, we hear about companies where developers are on call for applications they wrote,
mm-hmm.
and that SRE or like the operations is more to like work the framework or create the framework and operate the framework, but the developers are able to push stuff, and the operations are a little bit more hands off the normal development or deployment of applications.
Right.
And yeah, what do you think about it? Is it like this, that we now have finished DevOps and now it's time for OpsDev?
I would say that the order of products does not alter the the order of factors does not alter the product, right? So DevOps, the way I understand DevOps is basically a methodology or maybe some more an attitude towards where to go. And I think you're actually right. In the same way that operations became more development as they wanted to scale and not put basically human resources into do things, they just wanted to do code that does things for us. Developers also realize that they cannot just be black boxed into the environment, development environments. Just push things to production and, well, there you go, operations take care of that. And I don't think they want to do that either. I mean,
I think it really depends. There's such a wide range currently what you can expect from developers, and some are really doing the DevOps way, but most of them I feel have been in touch or are closely contact to operations persons or service reliability engineers in the regard that they get told what actually matters when you want to operate a certain application or a certain service, because just from fiddling around with algorithms or code, you often not have the incentive to care about what I'm actually doing and how much time do I spend in that function and do the metrics. I mean, for instance, the metrics.
Yeah, maybe it is that this DevOps, that Dev and Ops meet only in production and maybe in pre-prod, so that like Ops forces, not forces, maybe it's so harsh, but let's say I go with forces developers to adopt what they have in their development DevOps environment, so what to force a process that operations came up with on the developers, and in development they can do whatever they like and there's no such hard focus on enabling them to mimic operations on their own local workstation, and that they then have Wild West when they're developing and then they are forced to go in line with what the company or what operations or what the pipeline is, so that they, it doesn't make sense. So that in operations or in the pre-prod and prod environments, there's a certain workflow designed by the operations guys, maybe, or like heavily influenced by operations because it has to be like operatable. But during development, they have a little bit, they can do whatever they like. I mean, in some companies or best practices to mimic it as well. But
I think we see kindergartens everywhere. But a solid engineer would actually care about: is this readable code? Is this a nice design?
Sure.
Is my work extensible? Can I reuse stuff? All these principles in the various communities are on the current mindset of a developer. That's what a good developer is all about. But then additionally, I think, and that was in the past not always the case, it's like, okay, what actually matters when this is perfectly running? So there's something where service reliability engineer can talk you into and give you some more insights and arguments to, okay, you know what, if it's actually running and your product is done, then X and Y comes into play and we want to be able to do this and that. What if your soft system fails? And from the very beginning of writing a software, you're not starting with the idea, how does it fail? You're starting with the idea, how does this algorithm really perform and does the job I want it to do? And I think that's the point where you can sit together with a service reliability engineer. And I would also make the distinction that even in a service reliability team, There should be personnel which are really operators. So I think there is a valid distinction to go, you are operating something and you get everything at hand to operate something, which doesn't make you necessarily a developer, but a guy who knows service reliability or reliability engineering definitely gives his input to the software developer, because I think that's for certain feature aspects just out of the scope of a day-to-day work.
Right, different discipline.
Yeah, it is,
of course.
I mean, in an ideal world, under the rainbow, this is all meshed together, right? I mean, the development environment should mimic the operations, should mimic the concepts of operations. Maybe it's not at this scale, but it's at least like the same images are used, the same versions I use. So that's
I think we're talking about different things. One thing you're talking about is reproducibility and how the developer eventually can push the code into production, and they are kind of responsible of the code over there, how it behaves, right? And what Torsten Hagen is talking about, excuse me, is more the reliability part of the code. So as he says, like, when I'm going to code something, I will think about how which algorithm is better for sorting, for example, right? With sort or bubble or whatever. But you don't care so much about Paxos or CAP theorem, all these kind of things. You're like, okay, this shit is gonna work, and I have connected to the system, but if it goes down, well, I still have two nodes, so it should work fine. But what happens if the other node is in maintenance? What happens if still two of them fails and you only have one left? How is it going to perform? And it's okay, it's these kind of things that you don't think eventually in the during coding, because when you are coding at the beginning, correct me if I'm wrong, what you think about is the main functionality, right? The requirements of it. Reliability requirements is something that comes of an extra step, something that you have to code on top of it, right? But it's not going to define the product.
But shouldn't this be early on also in the development phase?
I agree that should be.
Let's say you have Zookeep, or let's say you have whatever, like Elasticsearch or whatever. No, Elasticsearch. Or let's say Elasticsearch, and you code against only a single instance. And when you scale it up later in the process, when you have your functional done, then you put it into preprod and it has like three Elasticsearch. And then certainly there is something you haven't thought about before. So. I mean, ideally, you would have the same, or at least a little scale, maybe not 330 Elasticsearch instances, but at least three, so that you can code against a distributed environment.
Right. So what we're saying is, like, do you have all these skills that you want to bring to development? They can think about it, or you can put it in a place where they don't have to think about it, and everything will take care of that, right? I think one of the ways to accomplish that is either to build a system, as you say, when you have Docker and all this shit, it's redundant by itself because you separate the concern of reliability against the concern of the logic of the application.
You started Docker. I never mentioned Docker before, no?
I could see it in your t-shirt. You're wearing a t-shirt that says, talk me about Docker. that's a way. And the other way also is to create more, libraries or templates where the developer can just import from there, and the libraries and templates will take care of these kind of things. But that's in case that the product is mature and the infrastructure is mature enough to accomplish that. If you're starting something new from scratch, then you have to work with someone who has this expertise or knowledge to add it into your software.
Yeah, and what also changed, I think, is that we first were writing monolithic applications and all in the business logic, and it was very clear that you were sequentially thinking into this distributed
and situation. Let's wrap up this DevOps versus OpsDev first, and then we go into monolithic and distributed.
You just made this up, DevOps.
Yeah, I made it up, but I made it up.
It's not a term. Nobody is talking about OpsDev.
No, but
because it doesn't sound good.
Yeah, maybe it's... Maybe it's a German in me who wants to concatenate things.
Yeah, what you're saying is that ops are now doing more programming.
No, that's in the past. Like 10 years ago it started, or whatever, 5 years ago. Yeah. That ops are going and adopt, even they admit it or not, they adopt the software development practices of having code, infrastructure as code, and continuous delivery and reproducibility and so on. It's not like ninjaring in and changing an IP table. It's more...
Oh, we still do that.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway...
we don't advertise it, though.
Yeah, sure. I mean, ninjaring...
It's not recommended. I'm just doing it right now.
Yeah, but it should, like, at least after the fact, you should have the same change in the code, in the infrastructure repository, and then deploy it again, so that it's not the ninja stuff, should just be this shown short-lived ninja actions, and then
what you want to say is how developers became more aware of the operations or stuff, or more they basically run the code in production, and how that changed a little bit their way of working, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that since we are now moving to, and maybe I make a marker here, since we are now moving more into like more easy deployable artifacts, like having, instead of having an RPM package we have completely virtual machine images. Like this is a couple of years ago, and now with containers, we have container images that we can easily deploy and spin up on our more beefy machines nowadays. I mean, if you, I started with containers before I started trying to come up with a virtual environment for a data center, so spinning every service up in a virtual machine. On the laptops like 5 years ago, that was like you spin up three machines or four machines and then the machine was done. So with containers, the resource allocation and the resource distribution is much easier, and you can pack more instances or more services on the same machine because you don't have the overhead of running a complete system, but only the service that you desire to run. Where did I want to go with this, Hagen?
I guess you want to advertise for containers just, but
well done.
I think so, because of why do we need this from the development perspective? Because I think the service reliability engineering part was basically, it's way safer if we break something, if anything is run in a VM, because then we can respawn it again and we don't need to care. We just throw it away.
Yeah.
And that was basically, I guess, just the first attempt to come up with virtual machines in terms of virtualizing operating systems. And but again, there are like, we were not, as a developer perspective, we were still solving single defined problems. And then we decided, oh, everything needs to be a service now. And then we ran into, oh, maybe the network is partitioned. And oh, what does that mean for consistency and availability? And then we came into this whole thing of CAP and services. Then we thought, oh, okay, if we have silos in an organization, then the service is most likely a really fatty one, and it's doing stuff we repeat ourselves. And then 5-10 years later, we killed SOA and we came up with microservices, and that's what we know. So the problem of writing software is now inherent in, like, inherent in, I cannot say the word, but you know what I mean. You always have to talk about a distributed software system.
But this is also due to the fact that the hardware is now commoditized and on very, I think, cheaper and cheaper and more commoditized hardware, right? I mean, 10 years ago you had like IBM servers or you had like servers that were fucking expensive, and now it's explicit. But they were running like quite nice and they didn't have some failures. But nowadays you buy maybe more cheaper servers and they are they have a more a faster iteration cycle, like a faster life cycle, but they are not that reliable anymore. And when you distribute services, or is it a false thought?
I don't think they are. I think the reliability is the same.
You think?
Yeah. I don't think the separation of microservices and all this division, basically, it does not respond to a hardware commodity change. I think it responds mostly to divide and conquer. So separation of concerns.
It just popped into my head. I just articulated my head. But really, isn't it also?
You had this monolithic real IBM thing you were buying for, I don't know, a couple of $100K. And then you had to use it and blah, blah, blah. And banks were using it and insurance companies and do all this computation. But then you came, your IT was constantly breaking your machines. And as an operator, you were quite annoyed. And that's what I'm trying, like from the operations side, it was kind of like, how can I protect the system and the company for critical misbehavior of certain people? And then that's a safe way to do this. And containers is just a logical consequence of not virtualizing a whole operating system, but just virtualizing the processes. And in the end, from a software perspective, I think divide and conquer is exactly what turns out to be, because the complexity that developers put into something because of the lack of communication skills were, they come up with really too complex systems, and we needed a way to split them apart, but then we also needed a way to go for the orchestration, or how do you manage when you split up, you have a lot of stuff to care about. Now the pieces are now less complex, but now you have the complexity shifted to getting it all together,
right?
Or orchestrating it.
But to back you up a little bit on the hardware, I have to say that this is possible because especially network became cheaper. Now you can have a lot of
true,
connected
true,
together,
true. Yeah.
You have a better network and it's cheaper. That's
basic. There's a nice talk of Adrian Cockcroft about how expensive 10 years ago you had like 1 gigabit, maybe right. That was very expensive and you had a very long latency. If you, even if you would have a microservice environment due to the network you at the time had on your disposal, it was not possible. And nowadays with in AWS you have like 25 gigs between your machines. They updated it like half a year ago or so.
That's crazy, man.
And that's like, yeah, you can just push around data much easier. Yeah, true. Yeah, that's very good point that the networking is very, the servers coming closer together, if I might be a little bit more poetic. It's also a culture podcast.
We have just more capacity for gossip. And I think that correlates, like going back to Conway's law, like if you say the world is a company and has a communication structure, the whole world is gossiping a lot more, and so do our software stacks.
Also very deep. Thanks, Hagen.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I have only 20 minutes left. I need to drop some lines here.
Do you think that the gossip made us also more clever, or actually less focused into what we should care about?
Let's see how the German vote goes out, and we have seen several votes before that. I think that answers the question.
Okay, let's maybe move to what do you think, how will the operations change in the last, let's say, no, 5 years too much, but let's say like, what do you expect in the near future? How is it more herding the cats and trying to keep everything in line, because we have so many technologies now pushing towards operations like containers, Docker, Kubernetes, and maybe also software, more like development topics that are pushing towards being adopted, and you are the guys that have to, like, they have to block the, or kind of, they have to be a little bit more conservative to wait and see what really prevails and what is really worth investigating and worth adopting in operations.
It's a complicated topic. So from my point of view, I don't think...
Yeah, you can derail the question and talk about
I think
else.
It's good. From my point of view, I don't think, at least... As I said, from my point of view, SRE, DevOps, operations, whatever, is not usually people who is against changes.
No, sure not.
No, it could be. I mean, I can see the perceived decision like, I want to introduce new things. Like, for example, some years ago, let's put Go, everything in Go. So, why?
Because so, Christian likes it.
That's the thing, it's the new thing, right? So it must be cool. Christian likes it, whatever. And it's fine. But we don't say no because, oh, it's new, so we don't trust it. It's more like, okay, what are the advantages of it? Oh, it's new, and it does, this micro operation is so faster, like, but the return from investment is not so big, right?
Yeah.
So we try to maybe delay these kind of decisions, looking for better arguments to move on it, because to move from one place to the other is always expensive, it's not a free operation. And especially in the operation side, it costs a lot of money and time to adopt something new. In this sense, that's, I think, how VMs integrated, and we have a sudden guest here.
We cannot make a pause.
We cannot make a pause. Please come in. We have...
I can cut it out afterwards. Yeah?
Okay.
you need this.
You need only this. Okay.
These new people always playing.
Yeah. And it's again the front end that screwed everything up.
Yeah, the titans of the fuck-ups. So where were I? Yes, about changes. And in the same way that we adopted VMs slower than the, I want to say, development, perhaps, and also containers will be eventually adopted, but it will take longer. It sure will happen. It's just slower, of course, because we have a bigger environment to maintain.
But what do you think, how much of a... how to put it? I mean, it's a skill to be open to new technologies and make an assessment of how useful it is to you, right? This is like a very senior skill that you like you learn over the years you have experience. So like maybe some stay longer in this period, but others not. So if you learn new stuff, so let's say Go comes around and you say, yeah, that's the best shit all out there and I want to use it now, and when you are like 10 years in the industry you say, yeah, okay, that seems cool, I will look into it, but you are not that hyped anymore, right? So this goes down a little bit. And I mean, you are...
That's what you're saying. We need maturity into the product to support it.
But isn't it also that you need multiple types of people in the organization? I will do a marker here. That you will have multiple types. And so people that are very adoptive and very nice to very adopters, open. And then you will have others that are not that open. For instance, like a little anecdote from my previous, one of my previous companies, I worked in a team where I was the one that were the junior basically, and I was adopting new things, and I was like, yeah, let's do this, let's do this. And my master, my manager,
has changed.
And my manager said,
imagine,
okay, talk to Klaus. And Klaus was like working in a bank IT for 25 years.
Oh boy.
And I was always like pushing ideas to him, and like stupid ideas mostly. So I pushed ideas to him, and when he was saying it could work, that was the green lit, basically. And then I could go to my manager and said, ah, here, Klaus, you know Klaus? He said it could work. And that's the best he can say. Like, if he said it could work, then it was already, like, it was done deal. But most of the times, like 95% of the times, he said, yeah, no, go. Like, just move. And, yeah, like this inner, like, and the most boring or the most dangerous environment, I think, is where you have people of the same sort all over the place.
Yes,
right?
I totally agree. Yes,
and this should be cherished, and that should be like encouraged to have ideas.
Don't stop the startup dying. That's always nice to see. Like, they go off, and then we say something like, "Oh, they ran out of runway," and then you imagine 10 people falling off. I think that's something that's going on in Berlin, and that's exactly because of like, oh yeah, what the fuck could go wrong when we use Node.js in the backend? Nothing really.
Good. It's single threaded.
Yeah, it's single threaded.
It's
so
cool.
You can scale like hell.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, that's why you have microservices. You have multiple services.
Yeah.
No problems.
And I think that's the part where always consultancies come in, because they have exactly a good.
True.
They are really successful if they have the best mixture. They have these senior people who know it's very expensive to change something, because you go in and you have this Trägheit, and so you. To change something will always work against management, against finance, blah, blah, blah. But still, to improve some certain things, you need to know a little bit about the... You need to project a little bit into the future and see what you can do now for the change to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as a consultant, you need to be that missing guy, right? So maybe in one company, you need to be the innovator. In some others, maybe you need to be conservative.
You need to fill the gap, basically.
But just also something that just popped in, like, from...
Yeah, but I think, like, companies who don't have that often rely on consultant companies. And then there's a natural thing that I experienced so far is, even if you have people that are very edgy or in front of any hype, management is not necessarily listening to them and behave accordingly. Always, if you want to change something, it's way easier to just get a guy in who talks 2 days to the management and says basically yeah, and then management is sold, and then you get what you want.
Yeah, we had
otherwise,
this in the
project can actually go on a long way until people recognize.
I think we had this in the company where we both met, right, where the business logic was like done by an external company, and every time there was a problem with this business logic piece that they acquired by an external company, they brought in the company again and they changed the business logic piece again, and they didn't trust the IT department to come up with a better solution, so
yeah,
it was externalized,
because there certainly were people who were not so trustworthy actually.
Yeah, me and you.
I mean, it sounds like you are talking about consultancy as
No,
that's fine. It's a consultancy in a mean of fixing internal company problems, which
but
is more like
that. What consultancy is about?
No, in my opinion, at least the only consultants I saw that they actually were beneficial is when they brought knowledge that the company didn't have.
Yeah, but it's fixing a problem of knowledge.
No. In this case, what you're talking to me is they're trying to fix the company culture.
Yeah, no, that was the knowledge
it's,
about
I,
culture.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think it's actually twofold. You have these broken cultures that need help, actually, because something is really dysfunctional. But then you have also just, because you had this, like, all people are in the same lane, you missed out some new things on the market.
Right.
And now you have a lack of knowledge, and therefore you need expertise.
Yeah.
And but regarding serverless.
Yeah, no, wait. Yeah, let's get okay, it back. Let's get to operations
yes,
again.
You also asked me the question. No, just to follow up a little bit on what we left. Start to drill a little bit. Is you told me the future of DevOps? Maybe.
Yeah.
Was? Yes. The way I see it, DevOps. So operations and development, they're going to become way closer. And what Google started with the SRE, the real SRE, not what is publicized outside, is the way to go. In the sense that at some point we'll have an infrastructure, Amazon is doing already, where you don't need operations so much because they basically it takes care of itself, right?
Yeah. It's a framework that you operate.
Exactly, exactly. I don't know if we're going to be close there. I don't know if it's going to happen, like no one will take care of that or there will be some people there, but for sure it will not be as a requirement of such big team to get, you know, the hand of it. And then operations will get closer to development. And basically what SRE is in Google, right, is a developer guy which takes care of the application in production and checks what's not going good with it, checks into the code and proposes changes.
Yeah. Is it maybe like to make this DevOps, OpsDev thing again, that in the past the operations went into the territory of developers and said, okay, maybe change this. They made a pull request for a code that failed in production to fix the problem, like help themselves, and that they leave room again for like letting developers take more responsibility in operations.
Could very well be, yes. It's a way to touch. I mean, I've seen that happening seldomly, honestly.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's not
because again, it's different skills. No, I'm gonna say skills, but practice. But as time goes, you get closer into that.
And also something that just pops up into my head is that between dev and ops, there's integration, right? So most of the time you develop something and you have it functionally working, mm-hmm. and then you have to adapt it to your working environment. So you have to adapt it to your release pipeline, to your operations pipeline. And at the end of this process of adopting it, it's maybe mostly in the developer in charge of it to make it so that it can be deployed, so create an artifact that can be deployed. So let's say first stage, create an artifact that is running, which is just a bunch of Go code, maybe, and yeah. then create an artifact that can be deployed, which is either like, let's say an RPM package or maybe a virtual machine image or a Docker image, and then push it over the fence to operations, which is the operating artifact that we just try to reduce this integration part in the middle so that maybe the developers, they push out not a functional artifact, but also a deployable artifact that you don't need so much integration anymore, because this is, from my experience, this is a really the nitty-gritty detail, the very annoying part that no one is happy about, right? The developers, they come up with something that works, they say it works on my laptop, but to make it work in production, they...
So that's also the part of DevOps, I think, that this maybe missing or not talk so much, is how to provide the developers with conditions like, so production conditions like, not so much on the sense of, okay, containers, VMs, whatever you want to call it, where your code is going to run, but actual conditions in the sense traffic, real traffic, not just synthetic, but real one. Well, Chaos Monkey, we have it now, and all this shit. And I think that's what you're basically doing is, okay, all the problems that you might find in production, I'm bringing it to you, to development, so you can just trash the application, test whatever you want to. And I think that's one of the most challenging points for, I don't know what to call it, DevOps, maybe test engine or whatever, but that we're going to be facing after the containerization of the software.
I also think that if you, it's a little bit, I think also it's actually we are a little bit further now on the average development. You are not starting anymore with just writing in your dark corner and come up with something after half a year.
Some do.
Yes, but I think that's not the average anymore. I think the average is really you start and have your repository basically ordered. You start with the main hello world and you get everything in line in your repository to actually have that value stream. And with just one push of a button, you are somewhere where then you can call a guy and say, can I have 25% of production load from X? And then you get that. And you get that multiplex. Not that the production system is in any kind
exactly.
Involved in anything or has any critical parts in it, but you just...
Multiplexed or like...
Multiplexed. It's a copy of traffic.
Yeah, you just
get multiplex is like putting stuff together into one stream. You mean like duplicated?
I mean,
cloned.
We both understand each other. Yeah. Why you don't?
Yeah, because I'm like in the seat of our listeners, so, like our listener.
Oh, excuse me, excuse me. One, you're the director of the show, right? Right.
I think but, everybody understood multiplex very well. It's
yeah,
just you.
But maybe just for me. So you mean like cloning traffic? Yeah.
Christian, you are technically correct, which is the best kind of correct.
So, yeah, you just immediately go to where you want to be, just without any functionality. So it's Friday night and people start playing PlayStation.
Yeah, no.
Those are our clients, don't complain about them.
I will pour in more beer.
Yeah, this is also...
I have a meeting afterwards, but let me completely be drunk.
You can just...
No, it's just... What I'm saying is basically we are a little further, I think, where you go, do you know what? I have created this Hello World program and it actually fails because it cannot cope with the production influx.
Yeah.
Even not 25%, and then you go, no, sorry, but can somebody help me here?
yeah,
what,
totally.
What did I do wrong? It's just I'm trying to print Hello World and I can't. And then somebody goes, yeah, maybe you should use this and that, blah, blah, blah. And then you have these expertise around you where you go and like, what do I need to make it testable? What do I need to make it scalable? What do I need to...
Mm-hmm.
And then yeah, there are certain aspects you just all... And they you start with everything up front, just with a really bare minimum. And then you go further while you're doing it. But you have certain aspects are out of the way so that you don't have this gap of, oh, that needs to be 2 months of hardening now because we need to integrate it.
That's very interesting because actually how also these software developers are going to change in the future, right? Right now, it's not just coding some application logic that everyone more or less can do. But as a senior developer, what can you offer? And it's exactly what you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, that's something, yeah. Great, pause.
And on the same lines, maybe. I mean, that's.
But I don't think we are really far away from it because it's actually required. You know, you have certain systems up front.
You are.
You want to talk to your requirements already include go to XYZ, get the data, blah, and do something XYZ, push the data there, blah blah blah. It's kind of like.
Yeah, in a previous company I was working, actually, I did a project for that exactly. So it was just like a small, I'm going to talk about my work now. It was a small Lua code inside Nginx, which basically was deduplicating, that's the correct term, traffic, send it to a zero in queue, and every developer could just subscribe to it and get all the real traffic from production that was happening right in the moment. Yeah.
We go with Kafka, right? That's exactly why you want to have Kafka in some...
That was not Kafka, it was zero in queue.
But it's the same, like, PubSub
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But under the same lines, and just... I mean, this is, like, feature... traffic-wise, that's exactly what we are talking about. So having multiple versions of an application in your environment mm-hmm. and then route traffic or duplicate traffic or clone traffic or what do you say? Like, anyway, multiplex traffic... I still think that's wrong, but anyways.
It is right.
So, no, multiplexing is... But anyways.
Okay.
Clone how about future flex? I mean, having
future
one
flex.
Version of the application image mm-hmm. running mm-hmm. and then have certain images or certain instances. Yes, like the flag, like the feature says, activate a feature, a new feature maybe, just on certain images. So it's in the same realm as you guys talked about, right? But not having multiple versions of an image running with multiple versions of the software, but pushing unfinished code out in production, but not using it, right?
Yeah, so how that's changed from development environment?
No, but the thing is that change is that normally you say, don't push code that is not used, right?
Don't activate code that is not used. And usually production is activation. But you can push shit to production and
but
activate it.
I think also here's like, I know there's a delivery pipeline out there developed with ThoughtWorks together and AutoDE, where they have actually a configurable delivery pipeline. So it's written in code and you register features and you have like a table where you go on, off, and you can all mark that. But I think there are two things. If you can do the same thing with just pushing out new versions, you keep... on
no, but
having mutable images with different sets of features.
Yeah, but
I don't think it's valuable
but the,
to push out
we,
half value, half
just,
stuff.
Just a sentence. The
are we talking
is,
about very clever A/B testing now? Or
No, the thing is I think the thing is with feature flags, maybe I'm wrong, but this also, I mean, when we have this podcast, it pops into my head all the time. that you will unit test and you will integration test the features, but you won't activate it in production. So you will build up tests for all the features that are in your application, but you might not activate them at the end. So that you are not using a pre-prod staging environment that's totally different, that you're using the same, so that even if the feature is not used in production, it, the unit test and the integration test, they have to finish.
And so you're increasing the useless code in production.
Yeah, but you... I don't like it that you put it this way, but
I'm the operation guy. What do you expect?
But you're more mature because you're unit testing it over a long period of time and not having
one put that in production,
feature
right?
release and say, okay, now you have this 50 features and boom.
But what is the point to have it in production then? I mean, you can already get the traffic from production into your developer environment to do all that, or in your integration testing environment.
Because the code will be in the image and the configuration.
Which
is
image?
Also
we
in
have
the
containers.
Image.
What are you talking about?
I mean, just the running version, just the running version of feature X and Y, and say X and Y are depending on each other. So, depending on whether you have a female user or a male user in your service.
That's sexist-ish.
Yeah, but it's for instance what newspapers actually do, right? They define your cookie, blah blah blah, and then you get this or that.
Yeah,
and. I think for actually, like, you can now go and do crazy stuff and say, I'm tracking the events, I'm tracking the user feedback to my service, and then I know it was here and there, and then we are talking A-B testing. Then it's basically try that feature and see how the female part of my user behave, or see what my male or other categories your marketing might made up.
But that's not what you were talking about.
No.
That's the only thing where I see it's
now
valuable.
Maybe
I totally agree.
maybe I'm that's a little bit like outdated. I'm not sure. I'm making this up as I go, but as always, maybe it's that when your iteration cycle of pushing out images is not as high, and your the easiness, the ease of testing stuff, that. The feature flex thing was more in the world where the iteration cycle was a little bit slower, that you were not able to push out features very fast, so that you try to make the iteration of code easier, but not the iteration of images. So
I
don't know.
I can see a point on the feature flex, but it's not an engineering point, it's more a marketing point, right?
Okay.
Where you want to centrally activate something in a certain time because you have the marketing campaign starting at that point.
Okay, let's go from feature flex to something else.
Okay.
How about,
I have only 5 minutes left, basically.
Okay. I have one question, though. You were talking about integration. What was the first time you could say that the software community or like computer community was trying to already push code in the same way they were coding it into production?
Ooh.
Because I think it's a very old topic. I don't think it's something new.
No. It's not. But it was never really good, right?
I don't know. It was terrible. But
I mean, I think...
If I recall correctly, the first time that this happened was around Java. When Java was invented.
Java was like virtual machine.
Right.
It's what they tried to do with Java, right?
Yeah.
It was like having an abstraction.
The GPM now runs on basically everything.
Everything that is properly configured.
But now, okay. But because we had so many architectures and we have so many hardware even. True. But nowadays, the commoditization nowadays you can be certain almost that you have Linux on x86. There's no way that you can have anything else, right? I mean,
ARM.
That's the same as saying voting is democracy. It's actually not. We should not rely on x68.
No,
and we
but,
should not go
but
for this.
In fact, you can. Today,
it's
today
like,
you can,
why
right?
Why are you relying on million lines of code that some Scandinavian depressing person
but
wrote?
My point is that JVM had fixed the issue of having multiple operating system kinds and multiple microarchitectures underneath, and this was abstracted.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, 95% of the internet runs on x86 Linux.
Yes.
So this abstraction is not really needed anymore.
But is that not stopping innovation?
No, I
kick
think that's...
out Java is not stopping innovation.
No, just use Lisp machines.
No.
Oh boy.
Oh, we got him tilted. There we got him tilted. Okay.
I have to go to my meeting. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no worries.
They were the last words he ever said on this podcast. Use Lisp machines.
Yeah.
And modern processors.
Yeah.
These processors are 100 years old. It's from Neumann. It's like there should be something new, like diesel or something.
Diesel processors.
That's the last word you say on the podcast.
Fantastic.
Okay, cool.
Bye,
now
Hagen.
We leave the Java man behind.
Yes, bye. Pleasure.
Yeah, so...
Okay, so one
serverless.
One. Serverless. Interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, now we talked about JVMs and we talked about this long, like lasting and good. I mean, now he's gone. I can talk about Java and think it's good. What I like disliked about it forever is that it takes ages to start, right? So, and this, but that's, I mean, if you have a long running process, you don't care about the startup time, right? So what serverless will bring us is that you can even have, for each incoming TCP packet, you can start a new unikernel, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we are like talking about unikernels and serverless in conjunction, but that's like what unikernels are supposed to be, right? Having either a very reduced
footprint
mm-hmm. and a very reduced user and kernel space, or having a very fast startup time. So like I said, you could think of having a 100 megabit connection, and I think even a gigabit connection, where you have a unikernel spinning up in like 20 milliseconds for each incoming TCP package, and then makes sure that you don't have an attack vector where you need to spoof multiple TCP packets mm-hmm. because every packet will have its own unique unikernel. But I don't want to, no, I didn't want to go into the server or the security direction, but what are your thoughts about this new upcoming paradigm that no one's using maybe, but...
Oh, I think Amazon already offers, right? Of Lambda.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Lambda. No, even S3 is the first serverless thing.
Okay, do you know that?
Everything they do in S3 is now Lambda, and mm-hmm. they shifted it over. So every call you do to S3 is a serverless call.
What do you think about it? Well, very interesting. Yes. You know, but it's exactly this conversation we had before. Like, it's a new thing coming up. I'm like, still a little bit. It's hype right now. And I can see the advantage of it. Does it change the paradigm of operations? I guess that was the question. No.
No?
No, I don't think so. What is the difference between having this like super cool technology, spanning connections, and okay, security, I can see that. You don't have to scale so much. But at the end, let's imagine help, or you have something similar like B-data, right? What is the biggest problem that we have for operations right now? Failing hardware, for example. Now, you have hardware in your data center, right? You cannot replace that.
But maybe on the hardware side, okay, you're right. But on the software side, isn't the most imminent problem or the most like ugly problem that you have stayed in in software, and that you need to make sure that over a long running time or long running period that the software maintains like functionality, whereas in serverless world, if you have something where someone needs to authenticate it and authorize and so on, and all these steps, if they are serverless, if they are just event triggered, mm-hmm. so you say, okay, I'm user XY and I want to do this. And this authentication, this authorization, all this is just a serverless call.
Okay.
So
to where?
To a service but the service is not a long-standing service. It's just instantiating.
The service can be not a long-standing service, but the data that is trying to request, okay, that sure has to be. So
you cannot live from serverless. It's like you cannot live from air and love. So you need some state underneath.
Right.
So cannot be stateless.
Serverless would be the next step of having... state machines. Sorry, stateless machines. So
stateless machines on top of some state. I mean, we need some database or whatever underneath. But all this business logic that is not really needing a state mm-hmm. could be only instantiated when needed. And so it's much easier to debug in this instance. I mean,
of course it's easier because it's a defined path.
Yeah.
So there is no other way. Exceptions can happen. I mean, it's still software, right? And we build software. That as long as people do not code software, then there is no problem. But at the moment we do. So how this will change? Well, if you have a state machine, defined state machine, finite state machine, sorry, it's very easy to say how it's going to behave and to reproduce the issues. So that's what I'm saying. It's not going to change so much. How a service which does not keep state differentiates from this serverless part. No, I'm not talking about this microkernel, so fast, or unikernel, I don't remember the name. That's a different topic. It's more that from the application logic, it's going to be the same, right? So I don't think it's going to change that much.
But for this, I mean, that's like the next step in microservices is having services that are only event-triggered services that only last for the call, right? For this, you need a very sophisticated monitoring. You need a very sophisticated logging and events sourcing.
Why?
And you need tracing because...
Yeah,
I mean, that you
okay,
don't need
okay.
now because you can just see the state changes and the changes in a certain application service. But if everything is serverless, you cannot log into a machine and say, whoa, what have you done?
We don't do that anymore either. How we track, for example, within this company that we are together right now, unfortunately it's going to change that, how do we trace that our users do? We don't go into machines and check for logs. What we do is to check the event system that we have and check what the user was doing. So we basically do a composition of that session in particular, right? And with serverless, it will happen the same.
True. But if you see a problem in a service that is used by this user, you can log into the machine and maybe get more details from the logs.
No, we never do that. First of all, because the logs are already outside, so we can query them in a separated place. And second of all, because the system, as we said, is stateless, so the state already changed, right? It just goes from a departing path and then it starts from the beginning again. Now, the important part of that state machine is the initial conditions that started on. And because it's deterministic, you start with the same conditions, you will get the same error. So in that sense, it's way easier for the developer, for the operation guys to debug what's going on. Now, the key here is, as you correctly point out, is how to get information on what happened there. And this, so you basically move the problem for having it in the VM or in the computer traditionally in the logs to a separated system and how to rebuild it from there in a more centralized way.
Yeah, right. Maybe I'm too enthusiastic about... No, maybe I'm not. But
I just bring you the operation side.
No, I really...
What I really like, and I think is going to be very interesting, I think is the cost opportunity. Yeah. And that for startups, I think is fantastic. You don't need to have EC2 instance, for example, as you used to have in the past in Amazon. You just have this Lambda service or whatever, put there your application, web server, and you are done. And then depending on your traffic, you have to pay more or less, right?
Yeah, the prime example for Amazon is, I think, there was a service they wanted to write, or some company wants to write for the Euro Euro Championship, the football Euro Cup thingy.
Right.
And they wanted to make it so that you can record your voice or you can sing something, and it was sent to the server, and then a DJ, and I forgot who, someone, composited a song out of all the incoming audio samples, and then he was make. And,
boy.
And the thing was, they collected or they calculated. I mean, the service will be used like in a very huge spike, right? Mm-hmm. So it will be used maybe 2 days with millions of users, and then it will go very fast, drop to no user. And so if you want to do it with long-standing services, you need to come up with like thousands of instances of EC2 to handle the traffic that's coming in. And what they did, they used like AWS Lambda, and they were able to stand it up for like, instead of 30,000, or I make up the numbers, but it was like in the tens of thousands for just 1 month of operations to be able to handle the surge, the incoming traffic, to just like $200 or whatever.
Yeah.
The number is also not correct, but like in the hundreds of euros. And
it saves out of money.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah. And for, let's say, services who are handling incoming users who want to play something, that's the same thing, right?
Right.
If you just need a service to authenticate, authorize, and pull in safe games or whatever, I think that's also some cool, cost-effective thing.
The thing
is, if you're running it on-premise, then you have the same issue, right? Then you're just putting a layer in between you and the hardware that you have. I mean, that's only makes sense if you're using some kind of public cloud, I guess. Or you have
a private cloud can also be. I mean, at the end, you have a cost of hardware, right? So you want to utilize it to the maximum capacity.
Yeah, but if you have to run the peak traffic on your local hardware anyways, then I mean, you have it. Yeah. You bought it.
Right, but okay, I thought you were talking about the serverless or not, whether to use this kind of technology. I think you can utilize your hardware in a better way.
Yeah, true. Because if you don't have,
Very interesting. I'm very happy actually that you put serverless and not this new concept which I hear lately called NoOps, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, but NoOps is just someone else's ops, right?
Ah.
I mean, that's the same with serverless, right? It's not serverless because you need some... I mean, you cannot run it on like Teleb to run something. You need servers underneath anyways. It's just you don't care about the servers anymore.
Okay.
The same with NoOps. You don't care about operations anymore because it's someone else's ops.
So NoOps means developer?
Yeah, no abstractions, I think. That's what it means. Commoditization of ops.
Commoditization of ops. Interesting. Okay. Do you think... this is a pure question. It doesn't have bad, evil... do you think a company can exist, a software company, without operations?
I mean, if you call, like, spinning up Elastics or, like, Elastic Cloud, like EC2... I mean, with this new Lambda thing, I think... I mean, the operations changes, right? So you are not a hardware operator. You are not a operating
system
operator.
Right, it's what we talk about at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You are the operator of the framework, of this event thingy.
Okay.
So maybe... And then the lines blur, I think, between creating an application, like chaining together events. But at the end, I think what operations maybe is in this context is... having experience with how this will scale and how this side effects are, so that you are more like, you know how this will work in production and you have the vision of how it will scale, maybe.
Okay.
But yeah.
So I take your answer is no, a company still needs someone to take care of that?
I mean, it that's what operations is changing into the last decades, right?
I agree.
So you are not really... fiddling around with hard drives anymore. You are not fiddling around with... I 1 year ago or so, I saw a SUSE, like the SUSE set 2 or set 1.
Yeah.
This old supercomputers in parentheses. And being an operator there meant to debugging the memory issues. And memory issues, it was a grid of copper lines.
Yeah.
And in the cross points, there was a ferrite core. So memory meant to either load or like preempt or like loading this ferrite core, or like charging it or uncharge it.
That's a very old type of memory.
And yeah, an operator meant to have like a measuring device to look at if it has a crack or not. So, I mean, and nowadays we are like far away from this, right? So operation is like, and this is what operations is like the last couple of decades. Like, moving, abstracting away from the real operations like the core and moving up the stack, because software is also, developers are also moving up the stack. Like they are not fiddling around with assembler code anymore. They write Go code or they write Java code or they write Node.js or whatever.
Right, but they still have to know how it works internally.
Do they?
I think so.
Yeah, they should, but do they?
That's a different question.
And, this is where, like,
and it's also
where,
like operations guys. Do they know how TCP stack work? Do they know how the disk works?
Yeah. I mean, there's a
what
famous,
is C-scan?
There's a famous paper there's a famous paper that if you abstract things, like if you, and I think the application or the topic was some guy in an assembly line, highly automated, or not highly automated, but has an assembly line and he is normally interacting with a certain problem all the time. Like you have multiple levels of problems. You have like level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, level whatever. And if the thing is not really highly automated, then he has to interact with all these kinds of problems all the time. And it's very diverse and he is like multiple times 1, but he is also sometimes he has 2 and 3 and 4 and so on. And if he gets a new problem that he the new level of hardness of the problem that he never encountered before, the guy who is like in touch with all the different kinds of problems and multiple times over the course of the year or day or whatever, then he's able to crack problems that are like two levels higher than he has ever changed before. And this is like kind of made up, maybe it was one, but I'm paraphrasing the paper, right?
I understand.
And if you automate all of that out, and if he's only interacting with level one problems or with only a type of problem every once in a while and not often, he's mostly sitting around and doing nothing and just watching the system work, then his level of problem solving over his own level is like hardly reduced. So you can abstract out all the problems from someone, but then he is like not really, he's overseeing the magic, but he cannot really solve the magic anymore.
I understand.
So, and I think this is...
But I understand how the magic is forming and works. I think it's kind of the point as well.
Yeah, and that is to your point that you need to know the deeper... Yeah. You need to know the abstraction once you have a problem with the abstraction.
Yes.
So you can watch the abstraction work and say, yeah, everything is green, fine. But once you have a problem with the abstraction, all the abstraction is going away because you need to understand what's under this abstraction to make it work. So the same with TCP, right? You can make like look at the Elasticsearch cluster and say, yeah, it works, everything is green, but once it's red and then it's a problem with the TCP stack.
I don't know anything.
You need to know
It's a very interesting point, and maybe it's because I'm becoming old or something, but I see a lot of people which is just becoming operators of Amazon and not really computer people. And I don't know exactly how it's going to be. Maybe it's just let's say initial step for this kind of people, which are becoming first operators of Amazon and then discovering computer science behind it, hopefully. Or it's just they're becoming like that because the company does not really require any other service.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, I mean, maybe that's even nowadays and when we are like close to the same age, but maybe this is a problem for newcomers here because you can go very far without knowing shit.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we didn't have this, right? We had to learn like iterations. And maybe this is, I mean, the same applies that I said before, like 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 40 years ago, you said, oh, this is a Southbridge. Here, this block is
a Southbridge. Oh.
And this is like the keyboard controller and whatever. And nowadays everything is integrated, so you don't care about.
Right.
So you care about the abstractions more. So maybe that's like old fart to say that you need to know all this. Maybe the abstractions will change and the abstraction will be so mature that you won't experience any problems unless you are very on a high scale or whatever. So maybe it's enough to know the AWS API and some Go to write some cool service. And if you really have a problem, then you have this scale that you can just charge someone or pay someone to solve your very...
Okay, so that's what you're saying. We are becoming more specialized.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I'm not really aware where I wanted to go with this. It's just.
I'm sorry. I'm always very pessimistic about computer future.
No.
Have you heard that? I don't know if it's gonna happen, but I read it somewhere that they want to create a market for, so based on the serverless, right? To come back a little bit to the point, create a market for people to put methods, algorithms as product. So for example, I need a quick sort implementation in Java. You can buy it in serverless for 20 cents per use. There you go. And then at the end, you just need a couple of things, right? And then without knowing software, you spam, you have your system.
Yeah, but this is serverless, isn't it? I mean, you can have the serverless function.
I call it bullshit. But
yeah, bullshit. But yeah, no, I think that's the... I had university courses like half a year ago or so, and I went to we made a project of creating services like serverless services, right?
Microservices.
And my point was, there's no point to it, and I do it anyways. But my
because you are an early adopter, yes.
There's no point to it because what really is the interesting part, and really what drives people and what makes people uncomfortable is putting this stuff together, the orchestration is really what matters nowadays. It's not the pieces.
Right.
You can have everything as pieces, but what you really need is orchestration. You cannot...
But orchestration is as good as the pieces you're working with.
Yeah, sure. But without orchestration, the pieces are worthless. So if you have Elasticsearch and Zookeeper and whatever, and you can put them together...
As a chain, you need everything all connected. Yes.
Easy today to get pieces, but to get orchestration is really hard. I mean, we see it with Swarm versus Kubernetes. We see it with Mesos, whatever. It's the orchestration is really what is the meat here. It's not the pieces. It's not containers.
Interesting.
Or images.
Do you think it's going to be some sort of orchestration for software in the future?
Yeah, I mean, this goes the same under the same headline. It's abstractions, right?
Mm-hmm.
We now abstracted the single problems like index search. You get the Elasticsearch image.
Okay.
You get for every language you need, you have libraries to easily use it, even though you don't understand the nitty-gritty details of Elasticsearch. And I think really only a couple of them. I mean, myself, I use it for 2 years or so, and I was introduced by Hagen to it, and he explained the inner workings, and I'm still amazed. But you will get a lot of people, and I'll derate myself, but you get a lot of people knowing like how to create something, specific service, but creating a wholesome, coherent service that uses all the different pieces correctly and have them scaled in the same lockstep, basically. So I mean, maybe you create something where Elasticsearch is not a problem until you reach 100 users or whatever, but your Kafka installation is fine until you reach 10,000. And then at 100 users, you have to invest in your knowledge about Elasticsearch. And when you reach, because you have so many services and so many different technologies that you don't understand, every order of magnitude increase to your users, you need to take care of different operational problems.
Right. So you're looking basically for the next component that will fail.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You always, it's like, yeah, you look into your stack and then you say, okay, what's the most
brittle
part?
What's blocking me? Right. Yeah.
What will break next? Mm. If this is even a comfort to say what will break next. It's not like, most likely it's what's broken now.
What is bugging me? Yes. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Cool. It's interesting. We don't have more time, I guess.
I mean, I'm fine.
Yeah.
We have still one beer left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. I mean, there's something we haven't talked about, and I think, but I don't know if it's the right moment right now. I want to talk about it. Sorry, every moment, right? Operations and BI. That's, I think, it's a very interesting topic. It's a topic that it's getting more attention, finally. But honestly, I think it's the next changer.
But what do you mean by BI? You mean predictive?
Exactly, yes. I mean basically...
Predictive operations?
Machine learning and operations. That's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's true. And that's really true. The thing is that I'm wondering is...
Very hard, though. Very hard. I think no one has a clear path on how to get that.
And to get into knowing your, like making predictive computing or predictive operations or whatever the term is, you have to be sure or you have to be sure that your operational stack won't change much, right?
No. So that's also another variable within the data mining.
If you now have VMs and you create a project to make predictive computing or predictive operations, I don't know what's a cool term is, for
BI.
The current stack. But BI is more
no,
business
intelligence. BI.
It's not OI, right? Operational intelligence.
Man.
And if it's not coined already in the internet, I want to claim this phrase, like operational intelligence.
Trademark.
TM. But don't you have to be very, first of all, I mean, to make machine learning, the first thing you need to do, as far as I understand it, is you have to clean your data like crazy. And I heard from a couple of machine learning guys that 90% of the time they are cleaning data and 10% of the time they are doing stuff with
data. But you have algorithms for that. You have this PCA and all these reductions, right? You can apply them to different levels, different dimensions. You can apply many mathematical techniques to do that.
Yeah, but...
Okay, I think the problem is clean data, yes, but you're trying... I'm trying to work with you here. You're trying to say that you have to have a static environment or a very clear environment so you can work with it in the VI terms.
In a controlled environment.
In a controlled environment, okay.
You have to control the variables of stuff that's changing.
Ah, okay, that's good. You have to control the variables that have changed, but that doesn't mean you cannot alter these variables in a controlled way to alter them effectively the environment. So your environment can change.
Yeah.
Long you can control it.
But to be able to clean the data, you need to automate it, obviously. So yes. You need to make like a pre-cleaning, whatever. So you ingest raw data. I mean, that's called data, right? And then you refine the data as it goes through your data.
Yes.
Supply chain. This is a new term, right? This is a cool term you use now. Data supply chain. So first you have unstructured Wild West data, and then you need to sort out what you really need.
Yes, usually doing a fast Fourier transform, for example.
Yeah, but for whatever. Instance, I mean, I know of a company where we reduced the like 50% of the log lines by just kicking out sudos from our monitoring.
Right, and that's
solution.
That's so, a PCA, right? You select the dimensions you want to monitor or the ones you're interested into. Wait, one second. Before you were saying like, is that you can control the variables of the environment. Okay, so what you really need to do operations intelligence, was it?
Operation intelligence. It's my new startup.
It's basically a mathematical model of your environment.
No, but I think before you come up with a mathematical model, the data has to be as clean by someone with brains instead of having zeros and ones, because
maybe that we're talking different dimensions. So.
Yeah, maybe.
Our data is not clean.
No matter how, you have to clean the environment or the data, because whatever is your input, it will not be linear to the amount of work you have to do, right? So if you have like 50 line of input, then you will have more than twice the operational effort than 100 lines of input. And that's maybe made up.
But that sounds like a scaling problem.
No, but if your machine learning has to figure out more dimensions than it needs to solve the problem, but
right.
the machine learning doesn't know about it, that's why it's called machine learning, right?
But so that's why you have neural networks.
Oh, come on. Neural networks won't help you. Yeah. Because neural networks, you need...
You just put different neural nodes, it's called, I don't know, for different dimensions, as much as dimensions you have. Okay, it's a problem of capacity again.
Yeah, but the thing is with neural networks, you can train on something. So you can say, okay, I have the last week of my input, my log data, and I want to train a neural net to really exactly match this and this problem.
Yeah.
So like that's right, neural networks like in humans. Like you train in like with apples, and then next time you see the apple, it's an apple.
But that's
what
we do.
Really, no, but I think what you really want to do is have a machine learning algorithm that's not training a machine, a neural network, but like machine learning, clean machine learning that learns from inputs from your from your operations guys and say, okay, he's looking into something, and then you look into what he was looking for to be triggered to look into it. So it's a live application. You don't train something and then you just apply the trained knowledge.
Okay, I see where you go, yes. I was thinking more in the sense of you have metrics, right, that define error rates, for example, users, and so on, and deterministic error rates, for example, failing disks in this node, and then you see a drop of users, and there's an increase of that, of error, like disk errors, and then you train a system to say, like, hey, when this happens, usually this disk is failing.
Yeah, but there you don't need a mesh neural net for.
It's a very bad example.
I have no clue about. I mean, not no clue.
I'm not an expert either.
I'm not an amateur. That's my gist of it, right? So neural networks. If you want to predict this a face, then you train with 100,000 faces, and then you try to like, and then the next phase comes around. Then the neural network say, "Yeah, I got very cheap operation to say inferencing." It's called, right?
Yes.
Phase.
But actually, that's the point as well. Again, with the same example of the disks, for example, you have suddenly a huge increase of users. And every time you have a huge increase, you see the error rate spiking because disks are failing more because they're more used. So you can say, hey, errors are increasing. Be aware you're going to have more disk fails.
True. But I'm not sure, and maybe we can, if the listener that's listening to it is an expert in machine learning, I would really like to invite you again and
okay.
then talk about operational intelligence, the phrase that I came up with.
Man, you should obviously. Have started a spin-off of this show.
Just to talk about and then talk about exactly this.
So okay.
What can we expect from like normal machine learning mm-hmm. and what can we expect from neural networks and what is AI?
Yeah, so yeah, good like, point, right?
And what is a fields of that you can apply each of the previous mentioned
mm-hmm.
Cool. Cool. Yeah, cool. I think we have like 1 hour 15 minutes and
not bad. I was very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah,
I had to say no many times, but yes, you got me.
I mean,
I'm very busy guy.
Yes, empty. I mean, we almost. Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, as I said, we should invite you again, or I should invite you again. So maybe as an outro, I will leave Sony. I will go to Docker.
Boo. Surprise. Why you don't go, I don't know, to OpenStack? Or?
Yeah, because I like Docker.
There's no such company for OpenStack, actually.
I mean, Docker has a
Rackspace.
A Maymill is it's like. Docker. Anyways.
What happens when the Docker is gone? What are you going to do?
I don't know. Maybe.
The next version of Docker?
No. I would say I will stay with Docker until the end, until the very end.
And that's how the show ends.
No, it's very cool. Anyways, yeah. So again, this is not over. I think. We should invite you again, and we will invite you again.
That's the third time he says that.
But for the time, we will just make a hard cut because there's
okay.
too much to talk about. And
fantastic.
Thanks for being there. Thanks for listening. Guy.
Thanks for letting me talk. Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Happy to be here.
And see you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.